You are listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Persephone. I'm here in studio with Bill, and we're going to discuss Libya.
Right. The situation in Libya has been gradually unfolding toward a crisis, a bit chaotic there. Obviously, that's partly been the case since the end of the civil war and the assassination of Gaddafi during the civil war, or right at the tail end there after his government had already fallen. But the situation has been spiraling out this year. And the latest development is that the day or so before we were recording this segment, the United States pulled all its embassy staff, including the Marines, out of Tripoli, the capital of Libya, and moved them to neighboring Tunisia, which is probably the most stable Arab Spring country that seems to have made a successful, relatively successful transition, although that process is still ongoing. The situation in Libya fundamentally, besides the fact that everyone and their grandmother has a militia, and they all seem to be relatively equally balanced, is that everyone is sort of coalescing into two different factions. There's an Islamist faction, and there's an anti-Islamist faction. I use the term anti-Islamist specifically because the Western media tends to describe them as liberal militias or liberal generals and things like that, liberal officers. And to me, I'm not sure that liberal is the best term for, you know, a non-Islamist but also authoritarian regime. I think that's one of the problems that we saw with the narrative on Egypt, the idea that this was somehow a liberal government that was coming into power in Egypt. Actually, the Egyptian military is extremely conservative, religiously even, and, you know, maybe they're not making everyone wear beards or whatever, but they're still, you know, fundamentally upholding a lot of the religious hardline principles, specifically, especially with regard to the treatment of women. And we'd seen assaults going way up against women in Egypt and that sort of thing. The situation in Libya is that I think that it's much more easy to describe it as Islamist and anti-Islamist. So the Islamist faction, they're just basically, their motivating organizing force as a political party or coalition is promoting a sort of more, you know, Islamic nation. Much, I would argue, in the same way as many Christian conservatives in the United States would like to promote a more Christian-oriented nation, even if we exclude the sort of hardline Christianists in the United States who want to have, you know, a fundamentalist Christian government or something like that that's no longer the Constitution, just the Ten Commandments. Even if we take out that fringe, there's still a large faction of Christian conservatives within the Republican Party that want Christian values to be an important consideration in all policymaking and things like that. And even if we personally disagree with that, you can make a case that that's a legitimate political position to have and to have a debate on in the United States. So from my perspective, the Islamists were actually in power through elections in Libya. So it's not like they seized power to impose some Sharia fundamentalist state. They were elected and haven't really been able to pursue much in the way of policymaking. So it's not like they've imposed some sort of religious dictatorship. And I don't think that the people that are opposing them would necessarily be more liberal or less conservative. If you look at the example in Tunisia, that's a situation where you have a moderate Islamist party and then legitimately very secularist liberal parties in opposition to them. Tunisia was a very moderate liberal place before the Arab Spring situation. You know, you had a lot of people coming down from Europe to vacation there, lots of drinking happening. Whereas you might not see that in some other more conservative governments. Libya, again, I think it's a situation where it's more of these are two conservative factions. One of them wants to organize around principles of Islam. One of them wants to organize around principles of whatever, probably themselves. And there's a lot of different factions there. It's a very complicated situation. But certain parts of the capital had been controlled since about late 2011, had been in part control of certain parts of the capital. The Zintan brigades were one of the big ones. And very heavily armed. They controlled the airport. And then there were some factions in eastern Libya, in Benghazi, that were very anti-Islamist. That was, of course, where most of the uprising began against the Gaddafi regime. And that seems to be the heart of the sort of anti-Islamist resistance at this point. Although their allies in the West, in Tripoli, are the Zintan Brigade. But there, again, there are different factions that are aligned with each other for the moment. The Islamists, the politicians in the Congress there, and then they have their various militias just like everyone else does. And they've recently been having a serious battle for control of the airport in Tripoli following an attempted coup several months ago outside the parliament or Congress in Libya. And this has been ongoing now. The flights have all been canceled. You can't land there because there's just shelling everywhere. And you know, I think maybe 100 people have died in the fighting so far there. And it's sort of spread around the capital. But actually, most of the fighting has been happening in other cities, in particular particular in Benghazi. Obviously, you know, the situation that led to the consulate being stormed in Benghazi, the American consulate in September of 2012, that was in large part because there were so many different militia factions. That wasn't, as it's turned out, any kind of preconceived master plan. It was just a bunch of the different militias who don't really answer to anyone in particular suddenly deciding to pursue this. And the big development there is that you've got a large faction of the military, the Libyan military, defecting from the Islamist-led government, especially after recent elections where the non-Islamists won the elections. And you've got members of the military in large units and Air Force units with fighter planes defecting to this anti-Islamist side in Benghazi that is mostly coalesced under General Haftar. And he started leading these anti-Islamist operations to, quote, purge the Muslim Brotherhood and its influences from the country. Seems to be sort of aligned with the government in Egypt next door on the other side of Libya from Tunisia. So, Persephone, what's your kind of read on the situation that's been unfolding in Libya as the U.S. pulls out its staff?
Well, I'm very interested to see sort of how media coverage of that has played out. I've seen tons and tons of articles talking about the U.S. decision to pull out with the embassy and shut down the embassy for now. That's obviously pretty clearly motivated by the response in the U.S. to everything that happened in Benghazi. They're trying to avoid a repeat of that situation and of those criticisms. But I think what's interesting, too, is that with Haftar, there are connections to the U.S. And I think you were interested in talking about that, right?
Yeah, the biggest thing with General Haftar is that he's a former member of the Gaddafi regime, but he actually was one of the earliest defectors. He left in the late 1980s after a disastrous war with Chad. I think he was probably afraid of he was going to get executed for it. He left, went to the United States, moved to Fairfax County, Virginia, which is part of the D.C. suburbs, famously the home of Langley, Virginia, which essentially now consists almost solely of the headquarters of the CIA. And various intelligence reports and things and human rights reports and such that I've read indicate that there's a very, very strong likelihood that he was a CIA asset for many years. He probably isn't now, but that's harder to tell. Some accounts say that he's a U.S. citizen. I'm not sure if that's correct. I wasn't able to verify that because some things didn't say that. But the reports from Canada and various European groups indicate that Haftar was trained by the CIA and was sort of the conduit for the CIA to fund, you know, weapons, money, and provide training to various Libyan resistance organizations for many years. You know, that started in the late 1980s when that was after Libya had shot down some U.S. planes and such. That was sort of the peak of, and there was the Lockerbie bombing, the sort of peak of anti-Libyan views in the United States government. Then things sort of shifted, you know, 90s and into the, you know, first decade of the 2000s, especially after the Iraq War, when Gaddafi basically got so scared that he turned over his nuclear weapons program to prevent being, you know, invaded himself. Libya was a big oil producer, so U.S., NATO allies, France especially, particularly under President Sarkozy, got very close to Libya. So there was sort of a dialing back of this sort of wanting to oppose the Libyan regime and lead these resistance groups. But Haftar, for a long time, had been sort of the in-exile leader of a lot of the armed resistance movements, although he didn't really have much to do with the Arab Spring at all. And then sort of thought that he was going to just show up back in Libya again and be hailed as the new savior or whatever and be welcomed back as the leader. Apparently, there was a vote held by some of the revolutionary councils or whatever they were called during the uprising, and he narrowly lost out to some other general for control of the rebel armed forces against the Libyan regime. And he didn't really like that, just sort of bided his time until chaos was spreading. There was a New York Times op-ed that basically argued that there's a major concern right now that a lot of Libyans are so frustrated with the slow pace of developments in the transition and the sort of just unending turmoil and low level of constant fighting all over the northern part of the country, that they may just want a military dictator at this point. And the likeliest person to do that is General Haftar, who's managed to rally these mass defections in Benghazi to his side. He's now staged two attempted coup d'etats this year alone in Tripoli, both unsuccessful, I think in part because Libya is so, so decentralized that it's hard to lead a coup when no one answers to you. But if he manages to do this, there's a major risk that he's going to be in charge. And then again, I'm not saying he's a current CIA asset. He's probably not, because they probably cut him loose a long time ago when the policy changed. But it seems pretty clear that at one point he was a CIA asset. And if he's even a U.S. citizen, I mean, the Americans might not be actively supporting supporting him, but I've noticed they've been very quiet on a lot of the developments there, other than pulling people out because there's chaos in the streets and a potential attack might be imminent. They haven't really said a lot about his sort of machinations and open defiance of the government just because he doesn't like them. And the fact that he went and conducted unauthorized raids, killing hundreds of people in mosques and various other centers, saying, oh, well, they're all tied to the Muslim Brotherhood. And it's like, no one authorized you to do that. But he's got this ongoing operation nationwide to purge the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think that it's questionable whether or not he can really overpower anyone, because even if he does temporarily defeat the opposing coalition, it seems like his coalition could break up at any time as well.
Yeah, and I think it's just important to remember that in spite of whatever rhetoric we might hear, the U.S. isn't necessarily going to automatically support democracy. I mean, we saw that with Egypt. We saw that. We've seen that with, you know, the CIA's sketchy history. You can't just depend on the U.S. supporting democracy automatically if it's not the kind of democracy that they want with the people that they want in charge.
Right. And they're probably sort of looking at it and saying, well, this has been a really dysfunctional experiment in democracy, and therefore we'll just go with this pro-American guy who's lived in Northern Virginia in the DC suburbs literally since the late 1980s. I mean, he was living there, I think, since about 87 or so, or 89, thereabouts, all the way to 2011 when he went back to Libya. I mean, even if they're not backing him right now, they got to be looking at that and saying, yeah, that's probably more likely to be pro-American interests at the top of the Libyan government if he's in charge than if anyone else is in charge. Maybe he could actually rein in some of these threats to the Americans. That might be a questionable assumption. I think that the track record that we've seen with a lot of these covert support for various people has tended to backfire. People tend not to like to be controlled. They don't want to be someone else's puppet. And oftentimes that manifests by directly challenging the puppet master, so to speak, saying, look, I'm independent. And the op-ed argued that there seems to be this view in Libya that he would be a good person to have in power by those who currently support him because of his perceived American support. But maybe the Americans want him in power, maybe they don't, but they haven't said anything either way publicly, and that makes it very hard to get a read on that situation. Maybe the CIA decided that he's really unstable and can't be trusted or something. You know, we don't know how that relationship developed. Maybe the US government may not want to have anything to do with him at all, but they seem to be sort of letting it play out. And actually, I would argue that of all the possible US responses, letting it play out is probably the best one in this situation. I think that we've talked about this a little bit before. We talked about it last summer with regard to Syria before the chemical weapons situation, which is if the U.S. has a choice between backing one side, backing another side, or not really doing anything, should they not do anything? Is that morally a problem when lots of people are dying? In a situation like this, it's so chaotic. There's so many factions. In some ways, you got to kind of let it burn out. That's my perspective anyway. I don't know what you think the U.S. should be doing with regard to Libya right now, but my kind of view is they've got to sort this out on their own and see what they actually want internally. We shouldn't be imposing a direction for the country on them.
Yeah, I think in this case, it sitting back and seeing where this goes is the best option, not only from a perspective of possible intervention, but also in terms of seeing where things are going and making an informed decision if the U.S. is going to intervene in some way or even just show support in other ways, economically or in some other way.
It kind of seems like there's not widespread atrocities happening at this point yet. And if there were, it would probably be happening on both sides. This seems to be a very balanced fight for the most part. And it's not clear, in my opinion, that there's one side that's better than the other, particularly. I really reject the idea that the Islamist side is automatically the problem in a situation. I think I've made that clear with regard to Egypt, but are they my first choice? Probably not, but I think that they're not automatically the bad guys that they're often made out to be in the United States. Political discourses, especially, you know, outside of government circles, in many cases, this is what the people there want. You know, that's the kind of democracy that they want. And, you know, maybe that a lot of these governments would kind of moderate out of necessity if they were really put into power and had to show what they could do, unless they're able to form an authoritarian, unchallengeable state like we see in Saudi Arabia or something. That's never going to happen in Libya. It could happen in Egypt. It's a top-down state that's relatively easy to control most of, although they're having a major battle with insurgency right now. But Libya has been so decentralized for so long, it's very hard to unite it. It's going to be hard to hold anything together, which means by necessity, the outcome is either just constant fighting with each other or coming up with a sort of pluralistic, balancing faction solution that democracy is actually fairly well suited to handle.
That sounds about right.
All right. Well, we are just about out of time here. Persephone, thank you again for joining me in studio. It's great to have you back in the country.
Yeah, I look forward to future broadcasts.
Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at arsenalfordemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.